It is Monday, August the 20th. This is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us. Coming up, ending Iranian involvement in Syria and Russia's efforts.
Russia covets the status of being able to be a great power that can decide the fate and future of certain conflicts.
Toughest challenges for Pakistan's new prime minister.
The biggest immediate problem is the fiscal problem, and Pakistan will almost certainly have to go to the IMF for a loan.
Also ahead, reuniting families on the Korean Peninsula, plus a little something from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. President Trump's National Security Advisor John Bolton is meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem. They'll be discussing Iran. Mr. Netanyahu's office issued a statement saying he's looking forward to discussing ways to roll back what he described as Iran's aggression in the region. Bolton spoke on the ABC News program this week.
Certainly the objective of the United States, of Israel, President Putin said it was Russia's objective, is to get Iran, Iranian forces, Iranian militias, Iranian surrogates out of the offensive operations they're in both Syria and Iraq, and frankly to end Iran's support for Hezbollah. I think the president's decision to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal has put a real crimp into the Iranian economy. I think they're feeling it in their capability for the Quds force of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards to conduct offensive operations in the region here and in Yemen as well. But I think this is part of the problem with the Iranian regime generally and why it's such a threat to peace and security, not just because of its nuclear program, but because of its military operations and its support for terrorism. So that's certainly on the agenda here in Israel.
Bolton also said the U.S., Israel, and Russia share the objective of removing Iranian and Iranian-led forces from Syria and ending its support of the Hezbollah guerrillas. For some perspective on whether Russia is fully integrated into this plan, VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with Benham Talibu. He is a research fellow focusing on Iranian security and political issues at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
I think at face value, Russia wants to be seen as part of that effort. We know under Putin there's a resurgent Russia, a resurgent in Europe, resurgent against the challenges posing to NATO, and of course resurgent in the Middle East, particularly with its client state, the Assad regime. Russia covets the status of being able to be a great power that can decide the fate and future of certain conflicts. But again, it must be stressed that Russia really wants this for the social status and not really because it cares about the particular outcome.
Aren't Russia and Iran close allies?
Russia and Iran are pretty close partners. I would say they have some very, very, very similar strategic goals in Syria. But after that, they may diverge. And over time, we don't know what would happen after a post-ISIS Syria. Would keeping militias there? Would keeping Iranian forces there? Would keeping a network of Iranian proxies there hurt the Russian dream to regain its foothold in the Middle East or help it? It remains to be seen. But hopefully something can come of these meetings where the Americans and Russians and Israelis discuss the fate of Syria.
Bolton on ABC argued that the Trump administration withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal and his reimposition of sanctions have put a real crimp into the Iranian economy and even affected Tehran's ability to conduct what he called offensive operations in the region. Do you agree with that?
I certainly think Well, first of all, even in the run-up to the reimposition of half of the sanctions, which occurred on August 6th, that certainly had an effect on the Iranian rial, on Iran's currency. If you track the unofficial or the free market exchange rates, there's been about a 60% plummet on this free market ever since President Trump came into office. And that's the real Iranian economy understanding that this new president means business. When it comes to some of Iran's regional activities, however, I think we're going to have to wait till the November 4th sanctions, which have the oil sanctions as well as financial messaging service penalties, to really put a crimp into Iran's support for destabilizing groups in the region.
Bolton will meet his national security counterpart from Russia in Geneva on Thursday. What might those discussions talk about with regard to Iran?
Well, I think the first thing they'll say is they'll talk about Syria, and they need to understand what each other desires for an end state to the conflict. Is it just a freeze? Is it a rollback of ISIS? What are they going to do with the ISIS fighters that are actually growing in the center of Syria, the status of the Syrian Kurds, and, of course, the Shia militias, Iraqi, Afghan, Pakistani, as well as Iranian forces and Iranian bases. I think that the U.S. must absolutely make clear to the Russians, to the Israelis, and to really any local or foreign actor that it is not in the U.S. strategic interest for Iran to gain a foothold and then work to solidify that foothold in the Levant. And it should be U.S. national security policy to push back and eject the Iranians. It seems that the Israelis share this goal. I am still pessimistic that the Russians share this goal, but all efforts, diplomatic and otherwise, must be made.
Attacks have been made on Iranian positions in Syria, allegedly linked to Israel. How possible is a direct conflict between Israel and Iranian forces in Syria?
Although the prospects for escalation are growing, at least on the overt realm between Iran and Israel in Syria, the lack of a direct response to Israel's offensive against Iran's structure of bases, facilities, weapon supply networks, command networks, drone bases, and other institutions in Syria signals that Iranians understand that they don't have the conventional capability to push back against this very technologically advanced force called the Israeli Defense Forces, as well as the Israeli Air Force. I think Iran, at least until November 4, is going to be a little bit more risk-averse in the region. You've seen a return to ballistic missile flight testing by Iran, but still at the short-range levels. We haven't seen an uptick in Persian Gulf numbers for harassment in a while. And I think Syrian escalation remains more battlefield-dependent than strategic signaling. Once we get to November 4, I think the prospects for escalation grow considerably. But again, a significant dampener for Iran's overt escalation against Israel in Syria will be Iranian cognizance of their lack of conventional capability. And that'll probably take us all the way throughout 2018.
Without the U.S. in it, is the Iran nuclear deal on life support?
It is definitely on life support. And it's challenging to get European governments to see this, but it's something that European and Asian banks and businesses seem to understand. From 2010 to 2013, I think you had politics moving the engine of sanctions and diplomacy towards Iran. Now I think you have economics really moving the engine of sanctions and diplomacy towards Iran. The Europeans desire to keep the deal alive. The Iranians certainly desire to keep the deal alive. As we know, the JCPOA is heavily slanted in Iran's interest. But I think the Trump administration is showing to the world that it does have unilateral options and that the American economy matters and that it knows how to weaponize access to the U.S. dollar. And it's doing so far quite well. There's lots of potential potholes, of lots of challenges, but thus far I think it's been a pretty direct, telegraphed, and powerful strategy.
And it's Benham Talabu. He is an Iran scholar at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. In his first televised speech since being sworn in on Saturday as Pakistan's new prime minister, Imran Khan said Pakistan is in its worst economic condition it has been, and he's pledged now to cut government spending, end corruption, and repatriate public funds. He pointed to the growing divide between the rich and the poor and said he would adopt austerity measures to relieve the strain on the economy and tackle the country's foreign debt of about $95 billion. VOA asked RAND Corporation's senior political scientist Jonah Blank what problems Khan might face in trying to accomplish these goals.
The biggest immediate problem is the fiscal problem. And Pakistan will almost certainly have to go to the IMF for a loan. This has happened many times in the past, and each time the IMF has imposed an austerity program that the government of Pakistan has had difficulty implementing. So that will be the immediate challenge, particularly when the United States government has said that it will not favor an IMF plan that simply allows Pakistan to take what it considers to be extortionate loans from China to build what is called CPEC, the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor.
We also asked Jonah Blank what he makes of the Islamic welfare system Khan is suggesting.
He hasn't really given any details about that. He's been very vague on what this really would mean, and he hasn't put into play the trade-offs that would have to happen, because Pakistan's people really need a huge range of spending for their social welfare that no previous government has been willing or able to provide. Imran Khan has quite rightly pointed out the very low social economic, social indicators in medical terms, in family support terms, in educational terms. He has quite rightly pointed to stunting as a national hazard. He has identified a lot of the right problems, but so have his predecessors. And none of them have succeeded in summoning up the money and the political will to address them.
And aside from the faltering economy, the militant extremism, water shortages, and the rapidly growing population, Khan must have a full plate.
He does, and every leader of Pakistan does. The challenges that Imran is going to have to face that are a little bit unusual are that he is the first leader of Pakistan, the first elected leader of Pakistan, to come to office without much of an institutional framework. His party, PTI, is a very new party. Until this election, he was really the only member of the party who was a known figure. For most of its history, he was the only one who even had a seat in parliament. And it doesn't have the long-standing, decades-long support that its two main rivals, the PMLN and the PPP, have. In fact, Imran Khan has had to go to members of these two other parties, particularly PPP, for support. He has not gotten either support from either of these parties at an institutional level. But if you look at the members of his cabinet, over half of them served in the cabinet of the military dictator, Pervez Musharraf. Five others served in a previous PPP administration, including his foreign minister.
That would be Shah Mahmood Qureshi. Previously, he was a member of the National Assembly from 2002 to May 2018 and did serve as Minister for Foreign Affairs from 2008 to 2011. As for Khan's wish to get along better with Pakistan's neighbors and the United States, RAND Corporation's Jonah Blank told us, just like every other Pakistani prime minister, Imran Khan might be facing an uphill battle on that front. Following a rapid diplomatic thaw in the Korean Peninsula, dozens of elderly South Koreans crossed the heavily fortified border into North Korea today for heart-wrenching meetings they had there with relatives most have not seen since they were separated by the turmoil of the Korean War in the early 1950s. Chahi Stanfield is the executive director of the National Coalition of Divided Families. She tells VOA Asia's Ira Melman there have been positive expectations for an agreement to bring Korean Americans to North Korea before the recent North Korea-U.S. summit, although it was not to be. She also praised the resumption of visitations between South and North Korean families.
We are so happy that it's actually happening. But the Korean American divided families have been excluded from the negotiation they had in between South and North in 1985. So we have never had a formal reunion, or because we have never had a formal relationship with North Korea. In 2001, there were 100,000 Korean American divided family members in the United States. Most of them would pass away in 10 years. So right now we are at the very end of our lives. And we just had a Trump / Kim Jong-un summit in Singapore. That was our only chance, we got the last chance for the reunion. And we prayed for the summit with our whole hearts. But actually, there had been some talks about the Korean-American divided families in the news media. But it all turned out to be about remains of the soldiers.
So no Korean-American families will be part of today's visitation. Is that correct?
That is correct. After the summit, we understand that the U.S. government asked the South Korean government to include us in their negotiations. So I was told that the South Korean government had tried. High-ranking officials asked the North Korean government to include us in this upcoming summit. Reunion, their reunion, which is about to happen today. North Korea rejected it. We just don't know what's going on. We don't even know where we stand now.
Did you make any inquiries? Did you ask anybody at the White House or the executive branch if that had come up at all or if it even has been discussed?
We tried. We tried to reach the people we had met before the summit, but nobody's home.
Nobody returned your calls or anything, huh?
No.
Kahi Stanfield is the executive director of the National Coalition for Divided Families, and she was speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. This week-long event this week at North Korea's Diamond Mountain Resort comes as the rival Koreas boost reconciliation efforts. That's amid a diplomatic push to resolve a standoff over North Korea's drive for nuclear weapons program that can reliably target the continental United States. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists have measured the chemical compositions of 18 planetary systems that are as far as 456 light years away from us. The scientists compared the compositions of the exoplanets to that of our planet and determined that many of the elements found on the distant planets are not only present on Earth, but the proportions in the mix of chemicals are also similar to those found on Earth. Because of the vast distance of the planetary systems and how signals from active stars can overpower those from the planets, the scientists decided to focus on white dwarfs, or sun-like stars that have died. As a white dwarf cools, material from its former planets, asteroids, and comets are pulled in and sometimes forms a disk around the dead star. The incoming planetary material changes the white dwarf's spectroscopic signal, which allows for measurement of the former planet's chemical makeup. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Time now for a little something from the world of music. Headley is a singer, songwriter, record producer, and actress. Born in Trinidad, she and her family moved to the U.S. city of Fort Wayne, Indiana, when she was 15 years old.
A fairy truth and stories I've been told. At last, my chance to shine, and all in perfect time.
Heather was a member of her high school's resident show choir, starring as Fanny Bryce in the school's production of Funny Girl. After graduating from high school, she attended Northwestern University until the last day of her junior year, when she made the decision to become a part of the musical Ragtime and dropped out of school. In 1997, she originated the role of Bala in the Broadway musical The Lion King. And in addition to musical theater, Heather also became a huge hit as an R&B singer. If It Wasn't for Your Love is one of her fans' favorite songs. They also love the one about Heather's favorite day, Sunday.
It's Sunday, gonna be my day. Take it easy, make it all about me. Maybe on Monday, pick up my calling. Maybe Tuesday, we'll see how I feel. It's Sunday, gonna be my day. Take it easy, and make it all about me. We'll see how I feel. It's 9:30 in the morning. I didn't sleep well again. Tossed all night on board. Can't stand it when we fight like this. Here we go again. So I have to be gone. Can't deal with the fallout. Gonna take a time out. I need to take the day off. Gonna gather my thoughts, gather myself. I need some time without you. Without you, it's Sunday.
Gonna be my day. Take it easy.
Make it all about me. We'll see how I feel, but it's
Sunday, gonna be my day. Take it easy,
and make it all about me.
Maybe on Monday, think about calling.
Maybe Tuesday, we'll see how I feel. Maybe I'll just take a walk, a few blocks, get a bite to eat, see a movie, try to get in the key, listen to some Stevie. What I need to do is go to church and pray for that girl who got between us. Pray that I don't see her, pray that I don't meet her, pray that I don't try to beat her. I need a Sunday.
In addition to The Lion King, Heather originated the title role in the Broadway adaptation of Aida, earning a Tony Award for Best Actress. And one of her fans' greatest Heather moments is her duet with Andrea Bocelli, singing The Prayer. Headley's theatrical performances are numerous, including playing the role of Rachel Marin in the musical adaptation of Whitney Houston's 1992 movie, The Bodyguard, at London's Adelphi Theatre. She was nominated for an Olivier Award for that performance. And in 2003, Heather married former pro football star Brian Musso, who played for the New York Jets. They have two sons.
La luce che tu dai,
I pray we'll find your light.
Nel cuore resterà,
and hold it in our heart.
A ricordarci che,
and stars go out each night.
L'eterna stella sei, nella mia preghiera.
You know, Heather Headley is one of those rare musicians. musical performers, I think they're rare anyway, who can sing just about anything. It's amazing, amazing. Heather Headley. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. The latest world news is straight ahead, so we hope you'll stay tuned for that. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington hoping you have a super Monday. Now some more from Heather Headley.
To find a place, guide us with your grace. Give us faith so we'll be saved. In a fading care, I am
just. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Democratic Republic of the Congo will hold an election in December, hopefully leading to a peaceful democratic transfer of power for the first time in the country's history. Sitting President Joseph Kabila came to power in 2001, having succeeded his father, Laurent Désiré Kabila, after his assassination. Joseph Kabila was elected president in 2006 for a 5-year term and re-elected in 2011. Though his second term ended in 2016, and the DRC constitution prevents him from seeking a third term, elections were not held, and Kabila remained in power. Following protests in September 2016, Kabila's ruling party and the opposition signed an agreement known as the Saint-Sylvestre Agreement on December 31, 2016. The agreement paved the way for elections, prohibited Kabila from running for re-election or changing the constitution, and committed the DRC government to a number of confidence-building measures intended to create the political space necessary for credible elections. In November 2017, DRC's National Independent Electoral Commission finally announced for December 23, 2018. Many feared President Kabila would nevertheless attempt to run for an illegal third term, but those fears were allayed on August 8th, the deadline for registering presidential candidates, when the DRC government spokesman announced that Kabila would not seek re-election. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the ruling coalition's announcement of a consensus candidate, other than President Kabila, represents a significant step forward for Congolese democracy, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert in a written statement. We are encouraged by this sign that Kabila intends to uphold his commitments to the Congolese constitution and the terms of the December 2016 Saint-Sylvestre Agreement by not seeking a third term. Government, opposition, and civil society leaders, along with the heads of the security services, share with President Kabila the responsibility of ensuring full respect for democratic norms. The Congolese people must be free to express their views and choose from the candidates without fear of violence, threats, or intimidation. We call on DRC's National Independent Electoral Commission and Congolese authorities to take the necessary steps to guarantee credible elections on December 23, 2018, said Heather Nauert. The DRC has an historic opportunity to ensure a peaceful transfer of power in December, and the United States looks forward to supporting this process in accordance with the established electoral calendar.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.